Chapter 1. How hard could it be? Michael Houlihan drove to the far end of the Piggly Wiggly parking lot in Columbia, South Carolina. That's what he did in every parking lot, and it's what all good salespeople do. Park as far away as they can. The spots by the door are for customers. Store managers notice the courtesy. It was mid-May. The sky loomed thick and close, a dark, steely, greenish-gray. Michael didn't so much see the clouds as feel them, hot, heavy, and steamy. It was the kind of day that discourages movement. Ah, spring in the American South. Michael is a tall man, 6'2", a bit gangly, with reddish hair and an air that says he spent some time on a surfboard. He was wearing a dark suit, carrying barefoot wine samples in a bag over his shoulder, and holding a large foam core sign with a 5-foot-tall purple foot. This was not a guy they saw every day at the Piggly Wiggly. When Michael had driven up, a dark-haired teenager was collecting stray shopping carts and wheeling them back to the store. By the time Michael started lugging his wine and sign across the 30-yard lot, the kid had abandoned his carts and was sprinting for the supermarket door.
Hey, buddy, you better run!
Say what? Run?
Michael looked left and right. All he saw were parked cars. Did he hear the kid right? Then... the thunderclap almost knocked him over. Michael felt it in his spine.
Whoa, what was that?
He stood there, shaking it off. Maybe 5 seconds later, it began to rain. Not gentle, soothing, wimpy spring rain like he knew in Northern California. This was rain from a fire hose or a falling river. Buckets and buckets in seconds. Drops that fell like walnuts.
Got it.
In seconds, his suit was soaked. His tie was soaked. His shoes and socks and pockets filled with water. He started running for the store. Then came the wind. Huge, uneven blasts blowing hard from the left, then hard from the right. Michael's sign turned into a sail. It yanked him west halfway across the parking lot. Then it pulled him east. Then another gust pulled him west again. He was hanging on, figuring if he let go, the sign would land in Georgia. Left, right, lurch, wobble. Just don't let go. Inside the store, people had stopped. No one was checking out or bagging groceries or moving. They were watching this tall, fair-haired, California-looking guy in a suit, getting hammered by rain and staggering back and forth, wrestling with a giant purple foot. He disappeared out of view for a moment, then reappeared and heaved off in the other direction. He was barely making progress towards the door. The whole show took maybe 4 minutes. Michael tottered into the store through the automatic doors and just stood there for a second, catching his breath. He was leaking water onto the floor like a broken barrel. He looked up. The whole store, the shoppers, the clerks, the bag boys, the kid who'd been pushing carts stared at him wide-eyed. No one moved, just people staring. Michael stared back, dazed and dripping. That was the only sound, the dripping. No cash registers, no rustling, no chatter, just drip, drip, drip. Above them, out of the ceiling, that supermarket mechanical voice broke in.
Wet mop, up front.
A few seconds later, the store manager, a tall man with a southern gentleman's manner, walked up to Michael.
Son, I know you have something to sell me, and I know you want to sell it real bad.
Yes, sir, I do.
Before there were wine labels with dogs and bears and kangaroos, before there were viral campaigns, guerrilla marketing on any scale, before the wine industry had any sense of humor, there was Barefoot. This is the story of Barefoot's unlikely rise, its against all odds survival, and its surprising impact on a wine world that had not yet learned to smile. It's a snapshot of the American spirit, California style. It's about following your own path and having faith in your ideas, and about how hard work, creativity, good humor, and concern for people can both create a special kind of business and change the world. And it's the story of Michael Houlihan and Bonnie Harvey, Michael's business partner and longtime love. They stumbled into the wine business trying to help a friend. They started in a laundry room with piles of debt and only a hint of what they were in for. But as their new friend at the Piggly Wiggly could see, They always wanted to sell their wine real bad. 2 decades later, they had created an iconic national brand and a company with a big-hearted, cheerful soul. Along the way, they came to the aid of hundreds of worthy causes across the country, made friends for life in the wine industry, and helped make the world of wine something it rarely had been before. Fun. Their tale is a modern success story, and it's a parable for this new age of the entrepreneur. This book is also an operating manual filled with ideas and guidance for any business, beyond the rather obvious advice to stay out of South Carolina thunderstorms. Michael and Bonnie started Barefoot Cellars in the mid-1980s, but the name goes back to 1965 in an old plumbing warehouse along the San Francisco Bay. It began with Davis Bynum, a former newspaper reporter and editor who started a winery on a busy street in an industrial stretch of Albany, a blue-collar town on the north end of Berkeley. He was, at least metaphorically, about as far from wine country as you could get. This was the 60s, and if the area around him was headed for one kind of revolution, Davis was on the road towards something almost as radical. There was nothing close to a fine wine industry in California or America in 1965. It wasn't until 1966 that Robert Mondavi built his winery in Napa Valley. And though Mondavi had been in the wine business and in Napa for decades, people called him crazy for constructing a new place. But Davis loved wine. He had been making it at home for a dozen years and wanted to try the wine business, though he would tell anyone who asked,
"Any idiot can start a winery, but you have to be a tireless idiot."
He bought quality grapes from Sonoma County and bottled some quality wines. People who knew him as a home winemaker knew about a slightly less distinguished wine he had made that he playfully called Barefoot Bynum. Those friends may have liked the name more than the actual wine, but they convinced Bynum to make Barefoot Bynum at his new winery along with his better offerings. So, Davis resurrected Barefoot Bynum, brewed it up from low-cost grapes, and sold it in gallon jugs. And because Davis was both a guy with a sense of humor and a sense of his market, he called it the Chateau Lafite of California wine, just to be sure people knew the stuff was not particularly serious. The problem for Davis, and it was a problem Michael and Bonnie would battle on a much larger scale, was that many of the costs of making, bottling, and shipping wine are the same whether the wine is pricey or not. The taxes, the cost of glass, storage, packing, trucking, and more don't change no matter what's in the bottle. And those fairly fixed costs added up to more than Davis could charge for his jugs. In 1973, Davis moved to Healdsburg in Sonoma County, genuine, beautiful wine country, where he would become one of the pioneers of the Pinot Noir movement in Northern California, and particularly the Russian River area. Meanwhile, his accountant kept reminding him that the purpose of being in business was to earn money, not lose it. So, in 1974, he stopped making Barefoot Bynum, and the name went dormant. In the spring of 1985, Bonnie and Michael were living in a small rented farmhouse on a hillside of the McMurray Ranch in West Sonoma County wine country, above the beautiful West Side Road. They were just over one hill from Davis Bynum's winery, and Michael knew Davis because he was pals with his son, Hampton, going back to their days together in the East Bay. But Bonnie and Michael were only vaguely connected to the wine industry, and they didn't know much about the stuff inside the bottles. Actually, wine scared Bonnie. She was like many people, especially in the early 1980s. Wine seemed encased in an impenetrable code and culture, and she was embarrassed to ask about it. She couldn't pronounce most grape names and figured some snoot would make fun of her if she tried. She loved wine country, but didn't like feeling that she needed a master's degree to order wine in some restaurants. But Bonnie knew business, and her company, In Care Of, organized the offices and dealings of a few people in the wine industry, including her friend, Mark Lyon, an accomplished, unassuming winemaker who is now the head of winemaking at Sebastiani Vineyards. Back then, he was already working at Sebastiani, plus he owned 98 acres of grapes in Sonoma County's Alexander Valley. But in 1985, Mark had a problem. Although Mark was widely respected as a winemaker who brought an artist's outlook to wine, he was never enthralled with the business side of the industry. That's why he hired Bonnie to handle his office, and how she found that one of his biggest grape-buying customers, a winery in Alexander Valley named Souverain, owed him for his 1984 crop. Souverain was rolling towards bankruptcy and had not paid for about 300 tons of Mark's grapes. Michael at the time was working around the edges of the wine business, too, consulting on contracts, financing, and negotiations with government agencies. But he didn't know loads more than Bonnie about actual wine. Still, Bonnie figured Michael could help Mark get at least some of his money back, so in summer 1985, Michael started negotiating with Souverain. Problem was, the winery had been taken over by creditors. The people running the place were mostly trying to salvage some of their own money before the ship sank. It was a sunny day in July when Michael sat in a big conference room at Souverain talking about their debt to Mark. He was getting nowhere. It was the kind of conference room you see in lots of wineries, with big windows overlooking barrel rooms or winemaking equipment. This one had a view of tanks and a large, white, two-story room. In the middle of the room was a massive, polished metal machine with gears and levers and tracks. Michael had never seen anything like it. He got up and looked out the window. He'd been getting stumped for a while, so he was vamping a bit to diffuse the tension.
Excuse me, guys. What's with the chrome locomotive in the handball court?
Partly he was making conversation, but Michael was also curious. This thing was huge.
We call that a clean room, and that's a bottling line.
A what?
A bottling line. It bottles 3,000 cases of wine a day.
Wow.
Michael thought. He kept looking out at the winery's interior. He was thinking maybe he could claim something for Mark. Cables, hoses, benches, anything to ease the loss.
What's in those tanks?
Funny you should bring that up. Those tanks hold the Cabernet Sauvignon and the Sauvignon Blanc that were made from Mark's grapes.
Yeah, there are about 18,000 cases worth of wine sitting there.
Michael kept looking at the winery. The next thing he said came from desperation to recover at least something. But even more, it came from sheer ignorance of the maelstrom he was about to jump into.
Here's what we'll do. We'll work your bill off with that wine and some bottling services.
Wait, what?
What?
We'll take Mark's wine. We'll use your locomotive to bottle it, and that'll cover what you owe him.
Michael figured they could bottle the wine and sell it and earn Mark a chunk of his lost money. The thing was, in 1985, few California wine people operated like that. There were plenty of wineries with buildings, tanks, and storage rooms that bought wine in bulk and bottled it under their labels. And big places like Souverain rented their facilities and their equipment to winemakers who brought in their own grapes. But instantly becoming a large wine company selling 18,000 cases without any vineyards or buildings or even any land? That didn't happen much. But the Souverain people said, why not? Given their financial mess, they had no guarantee the wine in those tanks would ever get sold. They were happy to have one debt off their books. Michael was surprised to get anything out of Souverain, so 18,000 cases of wine sounded pretty good. He knew it would take some marketing and some effort, but he figured they could research this, use Mark's experience, and get the wine sold.
How hard could it be?
One of the first steps for Michael, Bonnie, and Mark was coming up with a name and a label. Bonnie gave them a starting point. It had to be a name she could pronounce. She was not about to be embarrassed ordering her own wine. Simple as that sounds, it was the kind of outside-the-industry logic that guided Michael and Bonnie through so many decisions. Their complete lack of wine experience often ended up being an asset. Most winery owners don't worry about looking bad in a restaurant, and they can forget lots of their customers do. What Michael and Bonnie did next was a step that can get overlooked by new businesses. They went out and talked to people. Many startup teams brainstormed to identify their strengths, weaknesses, and challenges. That's business 101. But that's just the start, because if you're new to an industry, you likely won't know all your strengths, weaknesses, and challenges. It didn't take much for Michael and Bonnie to see they were babes in the wine industry. So they questioned everyone they could find, and not just big names or longtime winery owners, although they did talk to many of those folks. But they picked the brains at every level, particularly people on the front lines. That would stay a guiding principle for them. They called it, no disrespect intended, making friends in low places. Those friends were the men and women with clipboards or grease and grape stains on their hands who could describe how things worked because they were the ones who made them work. Michael also talked to supermarket managers and wine buyers. They were the people he hoped to sell the wine to, and they were the ones who watched wine sell in their aisles. One of those was Don Brown, the wine buyer for the Lucky supermarket chain in Northern California, and something of a legend in the region's commercial wine culture. Brown was old school before there was old school. Gruff, abrupt, sometimes profane, seemingly perpetually irritated. It didn't always win him friends, but it was a style that got people in and out of his office quickly. It was late summer when Michael went to see Brown in Hayward, across the bay from San Francisco. It was a bit like trying to get an interview with royalty. If the royalty worked in a concrete industrial park with dark halls, the low hum of fluorescent lighting, and cement floors. Michael signed in, got a visitor's badge, and waited on a small, stiff chair outside Brown's office for what seemed like half the afternoon. He sat looking down the long, cement-walled hallways, expecting a forklift to come buzzing through the office space. When Brown let him in, Michael sat in another hard folding chair in front of Brown's desk. The office was crowded with wine and spirit samples from companies hoping Brown and Lucky would carry their lines. Brown went right into his act.
Say what you need to say and get out of here.
My name's Michael Houlihan, and I just closed a deal with a winery to pay off some debt. I'm sitting on thousands of gallons of Cabernet and Sauvignon Blanc. When I bottle it, what should the label look like?
Brown's grumpiness eased a notch.
You know, Houlihan, nobody ever asked me that before. I'm going to help you.
He looked away from Michael as he said that, lest it be interpreted as friendliness.
Don't make it a hill or a leap or a run or a valley or a creek. I got enough of those. I can't sell more. Don't put a flower on it. And for Christ's sake, don't make it a chateau.
He was getting a little wound up. Michael figured Brown was seeing the rows and rows of identical-sounding wine brands and thinking about how much trouble he had getting them to move.
Make the logo the same as the name. It has to be something familiar, something people will recognize and remember. And whatever you do, do it in plain English.
Got it.
Michael didn't want to get the man any angrier. He hoped Brown would pick up his wine when it was bottled.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Michael got up to leave. He had just reached the door when...
Houlihan, make it visible from 4 feet away. She has to be able to see it when she's pushing her cart down the aisle. Now get out of here. I got work to do.
All of that was gold. But that last point, the last sentence just before Brown booted Michael into the hall, would become a cornerstone of Michael and Bonnie's wine business philosophy. They just didn't know it yet. An equally useful, but far more benign visit was with Lou Toninato at Souverain. He was the manager of the winery's bottling line, Michael's chrome locomotive, and Michael and Bonnie went to see him to learn as much about that monster as they could. While Lou was explaining how the bottling would work, they asked if he had any thoughts on labels.
I'm no expert, but I have a label room here. Let me show you.
The room was Lou Toninato's library. It had every label from every wine that had been bottled there. Some were from little wineries and winemakers. Some were from big boys. There were thousands of labels and small trays that held them like index cards in a library. The trays lined the walls and went nearly floor to ceiling.
I see which ones get used up the fastest and come back to bottle more. And I can tell you that most of these only got used once and never came back.
There was a consistency to the failed labels. They were fancy with curly Q writing or ornate lettering or a script that looked like it belonged on the Magna Carta. There were labels that made you squint to read them and labels that looked like ink blots and abstract paintings. One looked like a carrot stew. Those were the ones Lou never saw twice.
You have to remember, these are going on a curved piece of glass. You're only going to see about 2 inches of the thing. Repeat customers have their images centered and visible, not on the top or bottom or in the right-hand corner. When a bottle is filled with red wine, it basically looks black. The label that stands out are mostly white. And think about the process of shipping a wine.
Bonnie looked at Michael. They had no clue about that process. They nodded anyway.
Okay.
The bottles come off the line in a hurry, and they get stuffed into boxes with hard cardboard dividers. Then they bang around on handcarts or in trucks, and these boxes get tossed into warehouses or shipped to back rooms at stores. Now, when they get displayed, they get yanked out quickly and nearly thrown onto the shelves. The clerk has a lot of work to do. That means lots of labels that get scuffed, and when the labels are in color, the scuff shows the white paper underneath. It looks like a damaged goods, and no one buys it. When it gets to the front of the shelf in a store, it stops the sale of all the bottles behind it. Plus, you want to keep it simple. One image, not a bunch of images. Your bottle will be up there with all those other bottles, and the section already looks messy and crowded.
Michael and Bonnie stood there and kept nodding. This was so much good information, they didn't know where to start.
Anyway, that's what I see working. But I'm no expert.
They wanted to hug the guy. He'd given them a masterclass on wine merchandising and almost apologized for it. And what he said connected to what Don Brown and the others were saying. They were starting to get an idea. Another stop was Petrini's Supermarket in San Francisco. It was just Michael again, and he went to talk to Art Mueller, the Petrini's wine buyer. He asked the questions he asked everyone.
What do you need? What sells? What don't you have? Where's the gap? We can bottle it any way you want, put any label on it that works for you.
Michael was in the wine aisle at the store talking to Art. Art was a very different guy from Don Brown. He wanted to help, but he was busy. He had shelves to stock and customers to deal with. While Art was trying to answer Michael's questions, a woman walked up pushing a shopping cart.
Hey, sir, where's the butter?
Art sent her towards the dairy case. Then a clerk came up with a question. Then a shopper couldn't find hot chocolate. A few minutes later, Art finally got to his advice for Michael.
Here's what you gotta do. Give me a salt and pepper act. Make it better than Bob. Make it cheaper than Bob. And put it in a pig.
Got it. Thank you.
Michael walked to his car, unlocked it, and sat in the driver's seat. He just sat there a moment.
What the heck was that?
The next day, Michael called Hampton Bynum, who was working as a winemaker with his father, and asked him to translate.
Salt and pepper is a way of saying white wine and red wine.
Okay, that makes a little sense. So who's Bob?
You don't know Robert Mondavi?
Bob is Robert Mondavi? Mr. Napa Valley Wine?
Mr. American Wine. Don't undersell him.
I have to be better than Robert Mondavi?
Michael began to panic.
And didn't your guy say cheaper, too? I think you have to be better and cheaper than Mondavi. It should be a snap.
How am I going to do that?
Make it good. Make it cheap.
Funny. I'm afraid to ask the last one. So tell me, what is a pig?
That's a magnum. A 1.5-liter bottle. It's twice the size of a regular bottle. Some people call them pigs because they're big and round.
When Michael hung up, he told Bonnie what Hampton said.
Really? Wine comes in different sized bottles?
Sometimes information needs to germinate, and sometimes the weight of it all will eventually hit a mental button or make an image pop up. The advice from Don Brown, Lou Toninato, Art Mueller, and everyone else had been bouncing around in Michael's head. He was thinking about his San Francisco Bay Area days, when he and Hampton would do what they'd call product research. Hampton had his keys to his dad's Albany winery, and they'd sneak some Barefoot Bynum wine before it got bottled. There were days they did research for hours. Now Michael was remembering the old jug bottles with the foot. They'd need a new label. The old ones had the foot on the bottom, and it didn't look lively or cheery enough. But it was a good direction. It was a solid image, without a hill or a valley or a chateau, and it could be fun. Plus, a foot was pretty straightforward. Michael went to Davis Bynum and worked out a deal. They bought the name and would start up a new brand, and Davis would sell the wine in his Healdsburg tasting room. This was progress, but he and Bonnie needed to figure out the look of the label, something that would be full of life, that would not get scuffed, that would stand out, and that wouldn't tick off Don Brown. Bonnie and Michael tossed around ideas for weeks, trying to be sure they had their concept right, digesting all the advice and information, analyzing labels they saw on store shelves. One night in October, coming back from a dinner with friends, it was Bonnie's turn to have the weight of all that information suddenly push a button in her mind. They walked into the kitchen in their little rented farmhouse. It was near midnight. Michael started down the hall, headed for bed. But at that moment, in the middle of the night, All those talks, all that info from Don Brown and Lou Toninato and everyone else, all the musing, it all bonded together, became focused and struck Bonnie like a thunderbolt. She had a bright moment of clarity.
Wait, come back here. I've got it.
Michael was exhausted.
Can't we wait until morning?
No, no, no. We have to do this now.
She was bouncing with energy, almost giggly. Michael looked at her. She didn't get like that often, but when she did, it usually meant something important. He trundled back into the kitchen.
Go to the chalkboard. You're the artist.
Well, sort of. He could at least draw better than Bonnie. They had a small blackboard in the kitchen they used for everything from leaving notes to scribbling stray thoughts.
I know what the label looks like. This is going to be a big success. I could see it stacked in supermarkets. This is going to sell a lot of wine.
Michael picked up the chalk and started to draw.